it's not just what is written in the law, but how is the law being enforced? Are our judges, lawyers, prosecutors at capacity to deliver these just solutions?
Climate justice is not just about the climate. It's a human right justice. It's the people.
When you share your perspective, you empower other people and you inspire people. And I think that we as humans work through empathy.
Welcome to the UN Capital Development Fund podcast, Women and Girls on the Climate Change Frontline. In this episode, we're talking about climate justice. It's a natural next step in our series, as repeatedly our podcast journey is highlighting the imbalances that are driving and shaping discussions around climate change and who has the power to make the decisions. Is it the women and girls on the climate change front line? Sadly, not often enough. And there's a good reason for that, and understanding it starts with a good hard look at climate justice. But what do we mean by climate justice? Well, happily for us, our friends at UN Development Programme have put together a very useful climate dictionary. If you're ever trumped by terminology or confused by climate concepts, this is the place to go. As it says on the cover, this handy little guide helps you to speak climate fluently. And this is what they have to say about climate justice. Climate justice means putting equity and human rights at the core of decision-making and action on climate change. And paraphrasing a little, climate justice is about the unequal historical responsibility countries bear in relation to the climate crisis. According to this definition, the countries that have become wealthy and emitted the most greenhouse gas emissions have a responsibility to help the more vulnerable nations, typically countries that have contributed the least to the climate crisis. And even within a country, structural inequalities around race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, and, yes, gender, all affect who carries the most responsibility to address climate change. That's climate justice. It's a big topic, but our four guests on today's show had plenty of insights to share. And who better to kick off this episode than Nupur Prakash, a gender law specialist at the International Development Law Organization, an intergovernmental organization with the exclusive mandate to focus on the rule of law. Specifically, Nupur works on the intersection between gender and justice. It's her job to consider how equity and human rights are at the core of decision-making. According to Nupur, the climate crisis is throwing a hard spotlight on how the rule of law works, on human rights, and our very notions of justice. The climate crisis, she says, is ripping open society's constructed faults and imbalances to reveal the unfairness that lies beneath. Climate change is exposing an underlying crisis of inequality that needs to be addressed if we are to find a workable solution to this global climate threat.
In our work over the last 40 years, we've really looked at the critical role of the rule of law in navigating many a crisis, and now with the climate crisis, although unprecedented in its scale, in some ways we see that at the very core of it, it is a crisis of inequality, a crisis of human rights, and fundamentally a crisis of justice. And when we say that, we also have very clear evidence and data which points to the fact that women and girls around the world are paying the price for this. When we talk about the impact of climate change on women and girls, this is not due to some kind of inherent vulnerability. And this is very important to understand. It's because of socially constructed disadvantages. Basically, women and girls collectively start from a point of disadvantage relative to men. And how does this come about? This is due to persistence of gender-based discrimination, inequality, and patriarchal institutions that contribute to women and girls disproportionately experiencing the harmful effects of climate change.
This is an important message, so thank you, Nepal. Women and girls' disadvantages are not natural or to be accepted as the norm. Women and girls are not inherently vulnerable, and any such notion needs to be challenged because they're social constructs. And where social constructs put the status of women below those of men, there's higher incidences of environmental damage. Bad news for women is bad news for the planet, according to findings gathered by IDLO. Societies with higher levels of gender inequality typically suffer from greater deforestation, air pollution, and resource loss. According to Nepal, if we are to successfully tackle the climate crisis, then action on justice is key. One will not be solved without action on the other.
Even now, we have pervasive levels of gender inequality in all levels of society. That means that women are unable to realize their full potential to contribute to sustainable development or in finding solutions to the climate crisis. We see this, you know, very stark difference between men and women when it comes to access of economic opportunity, access to land, biodiversity resources, productive assets. And then despite at local levels, we see that women and girls are at the forefront of climate actions. When it comes to decision-making, they continue to be marginalized both at global and national levels. Now, it's very dismaying to also note that if we look at the funding patterns in the world today, only 0.01% of funding worldwide supports both projects that address issues on climate and women's rights. And then put that into perspective with the fact that the more fragile a country is, the less climate finance it receives. So the stark reality is that women and girls' roles and contributions are under-recognized, under-resourced, and undervalued.
I'm just going to interrupt Nepal for a moment here, because this is the crux of the matter. When it comes to climate change, a global crisis that needs every shoulder pressed hard to the wheel, women and girls are indeed under-recognized, under-resourced, and undervalued. Nepal and her colleagues have thought long and hard about this, and they have come up with a three-point solution for action. Laid out in a briefing paper, Climate Justice for Women and Girls, a Rule of Law Approach to Feminist Climate Action. I encourage you to take a look. Back to Nepal and that briefing.
What does the Rule of Law Approach to Feminist Climate Action really mean? Because I know it sounds like a lot of words, but what do we mean by that? So at IDLO, we've developed this approach around three axes, which means that we follow three tracks in applying this approach. The first looks at empowering diverse groups of women and girls to claim their environmental rights, access justice, and actively participate in climate-related decision-making processes. Then number two is eliminating discriminatory laws and developing gender-transformative approaches to legal, institutional, and regulatory processes related to climate and biodiversity. And then third, strengthening women's capacity to access and benefit from land and other natural resources, and also increasing the greater gender responsiveness of customary and informal justice systems.
Nepal's three tracks to action are useful here. If I can briefly summarize, increased climate justice for women and girls requires that women claim their right to engage on climate change, cut out the laws that discriminate against them, and strengthen their position in customary and informal systems. Action on these fronts has the potential to transform millions of women's lives. Let's take just one example of land ownership. Women constitute some 43% of the rural labour force in the Global South, according to UN data. Yet they account for less than 15% of all landowners. Women's lack of control over vital resources, such as land, but also forests, fisheries, and let's not forget their lack of access to capital, is crucial if women are to get the recognition, resources and be valued so that they can meet their full potential, including on climate issues. The good news is there are people out there leading the way on climate justice. They are not vulnerable women, and they are adept in highlighting the value of what they and women from their communities can offer to tackle the climate crisis. They're activists and campaigners. They're warriors.
There is no other option but to be warriors. And I heard an elder talk a little while ago, and he said, being a warrior is one of the hardest things you can be, because you have to understand that fighting is the last resort. You have to understand that all the dynamics of everything that is happening, for you to actually decide to go out there and fight, it has to be the very last resort. So warriors actually have the purest hearts, because they are the most compassionate and the most empathetic. So if we're fighting, all the warriors today, the climate activists, is because we don't see any other option and we want to make sure that we're protecting this earth.
That's Shia Bastida. Like more of our guests on today's show, Shia is a young, self-declared climate activist. She speaks with passion, but also authority. She's one of the leading figures in the New York City Fridays for Future movement. A firm believer in the power of education, a previous topic on our podcast series, she's making it her mission to educate herself so that she can make the most of her growing platform speaking at national and international climate events. She may have just turned 22, but along with her fearless optimism and hunger for knowledge, there's a certain gravitas to Shia that I chance to think comes from her strong connection with her roots. She's a member of the indigenous Otomi community in Mexico. She's seen the devastating impact of climate change on her community firsthand, all in the name of economic growth and progress. A child of environmentalists, she points out that climate justice is not a new concept. It's been around for some time. But the fact that it's recently entered the mainstream makes now, more than ever, the moment for scaled-up action on climate justice.
The climate crisis comes from injustice, comes from making sacrifice zones, making communities expendable, and the fact that communities of color, Black, Brown, Indigenous communities, bear the brunt not only of extractive industries, of pollution, but also of actual climate disasters. And that's what some scholars call the perfect storm. And my community in Mexico is an example of that, because we are in one of the largest industrial sectors of the country, because we're right outside of Mexico City. So we supply pharmaceuticals, we supply a lot of food, auto parts and things. So our river that my dad used to bathe in, it's fully polluted now. You cannot go near it without putting up your window because you cannot handle it. And then we have had drought, we've had flooding, and no services, nothing. There are so many clusters of perfect storms, social perfect storms, across the world and across even so many countries in the global north. And so when you have that level of injustice that is just been building and building up, doing things that do not center climate justice is kind of putting a little badge on the situation. And this is the first time, I think, because climate justice has been around for so long, the first summit of International Summit of Environmental Justice, where the 17 principles of environmental justice were created, was in 1992. So that was 30 years ago. And we're just hearing about climate justice in the mainstream now. So you can see even how the climate justice movement took 30 years to be part of the mainstream conversation. And we cannot let it go, because it is our duty to truly address this crisis.
There are about 370 million indigenous people in the world today, according to UN estimates. While there's no clear definition of who is an indigenous person, they typically have distinct cultural, social, and political characteristics that set them apart from the dominant societies that they live in. They also share a common trait. Once again, I'm looking at the UNDP Climate Dictionary, and it tells me that indigenous peoples' way of life are inherently low carbon and emphasise balance between humans and the natural world. They are populations that are particularly relevant when talking about climate justice. On the one hand, they are marginalised. UN data suggests that while Indigenous peoples are present in over 90 countries and constitute 5% of the world's population, they account for 15% of the world's extreme poor, the poorest of the poor. On the other hand, they have tremendous reach over the planet's natural wealth. The World Bank estimates that Indigenous people, if not own, but live on or occupy about a quarter of the world's surface area, and conserve 80% of the world's remaining biodiversity. In other words, if we want our planet to survive the climate crisis somewhat intact, the inputs of the world's Indigenous communities will be crucial. Our next guest is Daniela Soberón Garata. She's a Peruvian lawyer and self-proclaimed climate change and human rights advocate. She's pushing for reform of public policies concerning environmental affairs so that they include a human rights or justice approach. She wants the custodianship that Indigenous peoples have over land, nature and biodiversity enshrined in law. She's not just campaigning, she's changing the system from within.
Here in Peru, we still don't talk about the interconnection between climate change and the impact it has this current crisis in vulnerable populations, especially in their rights. So when I'm talking about climate justice, I'm talking about a change of perspectives in the environmental public policies here in my country in order to incorporate a human rights approach. For example, here in Peru, we have a percentage of Indigenous people population here in the rainforest. And we talk about Indigenous rights a lot, even if we're still not doing that much. We talk about that. We talk also about environmental challenges. However, we don't talk about the contribution of, for example, Indigenous people in the crisis of climate change and how the preservation of their lands also has a collective benefit. So for me, that's an example of climate justice and what I like to address in my daily basis and also in my own research.
Daniela is taking practical steps to have public policy take a more human rights approach to implementation. She says that while there is much talk of Indigenous people and their special connection with the land, there is not enough regulation on the statute books to preserve that right, that relationship, under the laws of the state. One of the ways that Daniela is seeking to unlock the positive contribution of Indigenous communities is to bring decision-making processes closer to the people, a locally led approach that we've touched on before in this series and will, I hope, come back to again soon. It's an approach that brings another scientific advantage when we're talking about empowering women. Locally led action can circumvent traditional top-down decision-making and open the door to greater women's participation.
As women, we face a difficult path in order to reach authority or to become authority. So if the authority gets closer to population, then women and youth and kids will have more proximity and an easiest way to maybe channel their own participation. So it's really a lot of work to do from the authorities, but the national authorities should realize that regional and local authorities are closest to population, and this is the way to empower them, maybe in order to, as a consequence, also empower more silenced populations, historically silenced, like women, for example.
Putting equity and human rights at the core of action on climate change means consideration for all marginalized and vulnerable groups, not just Indigenous peoples. For example, refugees. According to the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, in mid-2023, there were 36.4 million refugees worldwide. That's people who've been forced to flee to another country for their own safety, whether due to conflict, persecution, violence, or increasingly as a result of climate change. Since the year 2000, the number of refugees in the world has grown by about a third. some 75% of today's refugees are hosted in low and middle income countries. The world's least developed countries, that's the countries with the most limited resources, host a massive 20% of the world's refugees, according to UNHCR. One of them is Fatma Moule. She's a climate campaigner and refugee in southwest Algeria. She's a Sahrawi. In the 1970s, her people fled conflict in the Western Sahara, a coastal region of the Sahara Desert sandwiched between Morocco to the north and Mauritania to the south. They've lived as refugees ever since. Just as Nupur explained at the outset of today's episode, climate change is throwing a light on the many injustices that are at play in our world today. For Fatma, raising awareness on climate change is inextricably linked with the wider injustices she faces living as a second-generation refugee, or of seeing her nephews and nieces grow up as third-generation refugees in Algeria. She, her family, and her community have contributed little to the climate crisis, and, as they are essentially stateless, they also have a limited platform to respond or take action. But being part of a wider climate movement gives her hope that wider social injustices can be challenged as part of a larger community of united voices.
So, one of the things, we are forgotten people. Not many people know about us. Our conflict is so complicated, a very long conflict that it's been decades. And seems like, especially with this fast-moving generation, that they have little focus on this long, prolonging conflict. But still, even though this situation is so complicated, even though like seems like there is no solution in sight, it is not end in sight, to be honest. But then, just let's keep moving forward, because the day we lose hope is the day of our end. That's one of the things that we kept us surviving or kept us believing in that future that never actually came, or that bright future that never came. Because every time there is a talk about climate justice, there is people who actually care about climate sitting together. If we got the chance to be part of the process of looking for solution, we believe that at least we won't lose hope. So climate justice is not just about the climate. It's a human right justice. It's the people. I don't need to explain, because we, everyone, I think right now in 2024, are convinced that it's not just about the climate in a sense, how the people perceive the climate justice 10 years ago. It's not the same as now. But still, if the people are part of the process, like women are one of the most affected by the climate. But then when it comes to taking decision, not many women are present there. It's the same thing for us. We believe that we should be sitting there, like we should be trying to not only make people hear us, but try to exchange with different communities, because we are not the only ones who are affected. It's a collective process, and we should be part of that.
Thanks to all of our guests who contributed to this episode on climate justice. Thanks to Nupur for reminding us that it's not women who are vulnerable, but social constructs that limit their options and opportunities. And to our climate activists, Shia, Daniela and Fatma, for demonstrating to the world that the climate crisis is indeed a crisis of justice, and for stepping up to challenge the status quo according to their strengths, skills and situation. Before we close, I want to go back to something that Daniela said at the very opening of this podcast. She talked about empathy and the importance of sharing perspectives to empower people, but also to trigger empathetic action. It's an important point, as, after all, justice is about what's fair, what's right, what's wrong. From being very small, we all have a clear sense of what's fair. How many times have you seen children squabble over who got the most, who was punished the least? Even tiny babies are triggered to cry at the tears of another, an inborn empathy that is perhaps part of our human condition. It seems, after speaking to the guests on this podcast, that those human connections are a great place to start from, to change the world for greater climate justice. And going by Gia's experience, changing the world starts with each and every one of us.
When I was younger, a lot of parents would tell me, how do I tell my kids about the climate crisis? Or what can I do for my kid? And the one thing that I would always tell them is, tell them that you believe in them. Tell your kids that you truly believe in their ability of changing the world. Because when my mom told that to me, when she told me, Gia, you can do anything you want. Really don't limit yourself to anything because you can change the world if you want to. That changed my life. When my mom told me you can change the world, I walked every day, you know, in my life thinking like, I can change the world. Why? Because my mom told me that I could.
Next time on Women and Girls on the Climate Change Frontline, we're moving from big picture questions to a more detailed look at the challenges and solutions. Our next topic is sustainable agriculture and how we can cultivate resilience and build food security. Join me then to continue exploring the issues around women and girls on the climate change frontline. And as ever, if you want to join the discussion or suggest people for us to speak with, contact us at capital.musings@uncdf.org. I've been your host, Sarah Harris. Thank you for listening.